Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm just in.
Conversations to have here today on the second hour of Mornings with Carmen. If you missed the first hour, you can always go back and get it at myfaithradio.com. And we're having provocative conversations today across a number of fronts. And student debt is a hot topic, not only in the culture, but a hot topic in many of our families around our breakfast tables and our dinner tables. And certainly as we look at our checkbooks and we consider how exactly we are going to help the next generation pay for the college education that they want. And whether or not the college education that you get is the one that you thought you wanted. So there's all kinds of conversations related to higher education in this country and Christian higher education in this country. And we have those conversations from time to time. But when Bill English is here, we like to talk about the numbers and we like to talk about the realities of business. And so we are going to have a conversation with Bill about the student loan crisis and the cost of education here in the United States of America and what it means for you as a young person or for you as a parent to take upon yourself the kind of debt load that many people are taking on today in relationship to higher education. So that conversation is up next here with Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. So joining us again today, Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Hey, welcome back, my friend.
Hey, it's good to be back. How are you doing?
I'm well. Bill is joining us today via Skype. We like to give them a shout out because they have better audio than cell phones. So there you go. So a little shout out to Skype for bringing us Bill English today. Bill, I graduated from college in 1990, from graduate school in 1993. Through a combination of what I would describe as, the benefits of my family and scholarships and a lot of odd jobs during college and working during the summers in jobs that actually, paid me something. I graduated not only from college, but from graduate school almost debt free. And that is just not the reality for very many people going to school today. And I'd love for you to just simply outline for us, what is the current situation in terms of America and student loans?
Yeah, I got to tell you that I graduated, just my history there, I graduated college in 83 and graduated seminary in 88 and again in 89 and came out with a truckload of debt. So I was at the other end of the scale that you were at. Look, 44 million Americans currently have student loans, right? How many Americans do we have in America today? Was about 320, give or take. So a sizable portion of our population has at least one student loan. The amount of student debt outstanding that needs to be paid back is right at $1.5 trillion now. And we're borrowing about $100 billion across all the colleges. Students are borrowing about $100 billion every year to go to school. One thing that you'll learn is that you cannot avoid this debt through bankruptcy. And actually, the word isn't avoid. You can't void the debt through bankruptcy. So you can declare bankruptcy. You still have to pay the student loans back. You can't resolve those through bankruptcy. And the average student in today's world, in the 2017 graduating class, had $39,400 of debt, which is probably going to equate, Carmen, I'm going to guess, $700-$800 a month for the next at least 10 years, maybe, and if they stretch it out, maybe 15 years. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, that payment for that debt crowds out the ability to buy a car, maybe the ability to save for a down payment on a house. And if two people fall in love and they've both got $40,000 of debt and their combined payments are maybe $1,400-$1,500 a month, it may crowd out their ability to afford a family right away, and they may put off having children for 5 or 10 years until they can afford it. Last but not least, 11% of all the borrowers today are more than 90 days delinquent in this program. So we have a real problem.
Okay, so I just want to review a couple of those things, because I think there's some of that that's going to be a real surprise to listeners. The reality that you cannot void or get rid of the debt that you incur in school, you cannot get rid of it through bankruptcy. I think that is probably a surprise to people. I also think that when you start doing the math, you know, if you're coming out of school with, let's say, 40 grand in student debt, you're going to be paying $700 or $800 a month for the next 15 years to pay that off.
Correct.
I think that when people are hearing that, one of the things that they're comparing it to, they're saying, well, you know what, I can get $100,000 mortgage, and that's you know, so for that, but the difference is the percentage, the interest that you're paying on a student debt is not as low as the interest you would be paying if you had, you know, a credit score of 800 and you went in to get a loan for a house where you've got some, you know, right. Am I right about that? I mean, some of the numbers here are the fact that you are not a person who has established credit, and the loan that you got is at a certain percentage rate, and you're really not going to change that.
Yeah, it's probably at around 8 or 10%, depends.
Which is horrible.
And
like
it is a horrible, because prime is what, 2, 2.5, 3% right now.
So explain to people who's making money there. Who's making money on the difference between 2% and 10% in terms of the interest on a loan?
The government.
Oh,
the government's making money.
Okay.
The government's making money.
Let's have this conversation about government subsidies, because people imagine that, gosh, we're going to go to this system where the government is going to pay for college educations. Who's going to pay for that, Bill?
Yeah, you and I, through your increased tax. Eventually, it will come out in increased taxes. And look, the interest that you pay on the student debt is not tax deductible. You can't go in like you can with a mortgage and deduct the interest. So this is after tax dollars. So when you look at what does a person need to make? Let's just frame up something real quick. Let's say they spend $1,000 a month on groceries and food, and another $1,000 a month on rent, and they have a $700 a month student loan payment. So it's $2,700 after tax, right? You got to earn about $3,400 a month to get to that $2,700. And so you got to come out with a $40,000 to $45,000 a year job if you're going to live on your own and have some level of a decent life, and yet be able to afford your student loan at the same time. You're going to have to be in the low to mid 40s just to begin to afford this. Or guess what? You're going back with mom and dad. You're going to go back and live with mom and dad for a few years and try to get your loans paid off. I mean, this is just the reality.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, mom and dad, if you're listening, the student debt that your child is incurring in college is going to come back to haunt you. Like, right? We have to help young people figure this out in some other way, through scholarships. Like, let's have that be a part of this conversation. Let's have working be a part of the conversation. Let's have taking a gap year to earn some income in order that you have some money going into this. Let's talk about working during college. And I know that, you know, for some people who are listening, they're saying, I did all that and I still came out with student debt. And I recognize that. But there are ways to go to school in a more economic way than some people are choosing to go to school. Bill, did you hear the story of the Morehouse College graduating class where the commencement speaker is going to pay off all of their student loans?
Wasn't that something?
Okay, so that's extraordinary, but the numbers, I think, were staggering. How much, I can't even remember off the top of my head, but it was just an enormous number in terms of the debt that those 400 students owed in terms of their student loans. It came out to about $100,000 per person.
Yeah, and that's not unusual in some of these Ivy League private schools, some of the ones that are more expensive. You know, I'm standing here in Houston looking over the campus of Rice University. That's not an inexpensive school, right? And so I think he pledged $40 million, if I remember the article correctly, and paid off every – isn't that something?
It's totally extraordinary. It's just completely extraordinary. Okay, so we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna continue this conversation about the rising cost of school and the cost of all goods rising at a different rate during that same period, and then the reasons for the cost of the increase, and then some solutions. All right, that's what's coming up. So if you have a college-bound student, if you have a recent college grad, if you are the parent or grandparent of any of these people, this is a conversation that you don't want to miss. More with Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com in just a minute. I like that little graduation music. Thank you, Paul Perreault, for working that in there.
No problem. Nicely done.
So Bill English is here with us via Skype from BibleandBusiness.com. We are talking about student debt. Bill, talk about the cost side of higher education in America.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me it's multifaceted as to why it's gone up. First of all, there is a report put out by the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. It's part of the Department of Labor. And they found that between 2006 and 2016, college tuition and fees increased 63% in that 11-year period, whereas the cost of all other goods combined, you know, averaged out, only increased 21%. So you have to ask yourself, you know, why did normal goods and services go up 21% over that 11 years, and yet the cost of college was triple, 63%? Why did that go up that high? And I got to think it's just a combination of things, increased regulations from the Department of Labor, increased cost to maintain aging buildings on some of these campuses, and yet at the same time, a lot of money to build the latest and greatest facilities. Some of these new colleges like Grand Canyon University and others, they're just building Taj Mahals with the latest amenities and the latest of everything to try to attract students. That's very expensive. Top faculty get more money. There's generous coaching salaries. Now, you look at Nick Saban down at the University of Alabama. I think he's making, I thought it was $8 or $10 million a year to coach their football team.
Oh, yes, but he's worth every penny.
Yeah, because look at all the TV revenue he brings back to the university. Seriously.
No, it's you exactly know, right.
You know, any school that gets to the Final Four in March Madness basketball, they get $1 million back to the school. So those coaches, that becomes something that colleges look at. But I also think because of the way that the Department of Education has regulations in terms of fairness, that they mandate that if you have Program A, you also have to have Program B. And Program B may lose money, but in order to have Program A, you have to have Program B. So, for example, I'm going to be facetious here to make the point. If you're going to have a business degree, you also have to have a basket weaving degree or something like that. And so some of these programs that lose money are dependent upon other programs that make money. And so they raise the price of the programs that are making money in order to cover the losses sometimes that are mandated, I think, by the Department of Education. Health insurance is a big deal, and anytime you subsidize something, to my way of thinking, you increase artificially the demand for it, and you also artificially increase the price of it. And so those are some reasons why I think the costs have been going up in colleges.
Bill, we have some listener questions.
Sure.
And so here's a question from a listener. What about debt consolidation companies? They say that they will save you money. Is it a good idea?
Yeah, it is. If you can get the interest rate down and you don't extend the payments out farther than what they would have been extended out to begin with. But most of them are going to consolidate and extend the payments out, and your overall amount that you pay on interest may be more than what you would have paid had you just stayed with the program. thing is, if it lowers your monthly payment and allows you to have better cash flow, then that might be the thing to do.
So that conversation, though, gets us into credit scores. And, you know, part of the reality of all of this is that students, particularly those coming right out of college, tend to get delinquent pretty quickly in terms of repaying their student loans. And that affects their credit score. And then when they try to get some other form of credit, they end up paying higher interest on everything else because their credit is now so poor because of failure to pay back their student loans in a timely manner.
Yep, there you're describing a classic domino effect of debt.
Yeah, dominoes is not my favorite game. Okay, so here's a listener. Well, that's that whole adding thing. Okay, so here's a listener who says, you know, we've got student loans. We're starting to pay them off. We also have the ability to do an income-based payback plan. I'm not sure if we should or the high payment plan. Your thoughts on that?
I don't even know what an income-based payment plan is.
Oh, so my guess is they stretch your payments out over time if you're not making this, you know, where we talked about the kind of money that you got to make. You got to each have a 40K job, you know, coming out of college in order to start paying your college loans back at, you know, maybe the regular rate. But my guess is if you're not making that much, they're going to stretch your payments out over time. If you stretch your payments out over time, you're going to end up paying a lot more in interest. And so the faster you can, this will be my own personal opinion here. I am not a finance advisor, nor do I even play one on the radio. But the faster you can pay off your debt, even if you have to really scrimp and eat beans and rice in the meantime, the faster you can pay off your debt, the better off you're going to be in the long term. Yes, Bill?
Yeah, I would agree. The servant or the borrower is servant to the lender. And sometimes you are forced into these positions because life doesn't treat you well in terms of your income, but all things being equal, yeah, I would pay that off sooner rather than later.
Okay, so I'm gonna give people a happy good news walk off here. We have talked on the program in the past about efforts to pay off medical debt for neighbors through something called RIP medical debt. And there's actually Paul Perot sent me an article about a church near Howard University that actually in the Washington, D.C. area, they did a month-long fast. And after that month-long fast, they paid off the student debt of 34 college seniors at their neighboring university at Howard University. And so let me just say to you, if you are a member of a church and this is of concern to you, this is something that you can do. This is something that you can do. You could work to pay off the medical debt that's crippling your neighbors through RIP medical debt. We talked about that back in, I want to say that was April the 8th, 4/8/2019. If you want to grab that podcast at myfaithradio.com or check out this article from a church near Howard University that has paid off the student debt of 34 graduating seniors so that they can really get rocking and rolling. And they did a month-long fast in order to make the sacrifices necessary to pay off that debt. All right, Bill, any walk-off thoughts?
You know, once business in America begins to value certificates more than they value degrees, you will see a sea change in how colleges deliver education.
Ooh, interesting. Oh, I feel like that's a spicy topic. Okay,
it is.
Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com, thank you, as always, for the conversation.
You bet. Have a good day.
You too. All right, let's take a break for Breakpoint. Okay, I'm really enjoying the back and forth with all of you on the text line. Obviously, the student debt conversation is a real one out there. Lots of folks texting in, and Bill, when he's back on, we're going to have to talk with him about that little teasing walk-off he gave us about certificates versus degrees from an employer perspective. Lots of folks interested in hearing about that. So remember, you can always text me during the show, 877-933-2484. And you can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. We love the listener engagement. And so thank you so much for listening and engaging. So the immigration conversation is an important one. And what is happening at the U.S. southern border is a critical conversation for us to be engaged in. We need to know actually what's happening on the ground. So we have, you know, friends who have been there, have actually, like, seen it up close and personal. Alan Cross from the Community Development Initiatives for the Montgomery Baptist Association is going to be here with us next. He is the Executive Director of Community Development Initiatives, CDIonline.org. And you can, we're going to find out from him what's happening on the border, what Christians are doing to respond on the border, and how you and I can actually start the conversation in our local communities and churches, because I think that we all need some marching orders in relationship to this. So Alan Cross will be here up next.
Looks can be deceiving, and you can't judge a teen by his behavior any more than you can judge a book by its cover. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Moms and dads have a habit of labeling disobedient kids as rebels. But 9 times out of 10, their so-called rebellion is just a natural response to a past or present issue in their life. Unless parents understand the root cause, they won't be able to stop the behavior and encourage healing within the family. If you're the parent of a so-called rebellious teenager, is your teen's inappropriate behavior actually rebellion or the symptoms of a deeper issue? So go beyond what you see and look into the heart of your teen. What looks like rebellion to you could really be a cry for help.
Parenting Teens isn't for the faint of heart. Want more help from Mark Gregston? Check out his latest resources online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Okay, before we get to Alan Cross, I have to do one little listener response here, because I love it that you guys are engaging the conversation about helping me come up with an antonym for gossip. Like, we need a word. We need a word that is the opposite of gossip so that we can celebrate people who actually tell on, or the tattletales of people who do good. And so thank you to this listener who sent me this. So what about the word encourager? Encourager is the opposite of gossip. And then they remind me of Barnabas, the son of encouragement. So now I'm having a little moment of inspiration. What if we talked about the people as Barnabases, and we talked about the opposite, or the antonym of gossip, being a Barnabal? Like, so, you know, you instead of gossip, you're Barnabling.
Not abominable.
No, Barnabal. Barnabal. Like, right? Son of encouragement? Like, yeah. Barnabal. I don't know. I really want a new word. I really don't want one of these. Well, there's these hackneyed words out there that you guys keep throwing at me that I cannot pronounce, and they sound like bad things. And so I feel like we need to craft a new word. And so I might start using Barnabal and Barnabas and Barnabling. And so let's just try that out and see how it works. Okay, up now, Alan Cross, who is a person who does good, and I like to catch him doing good and then tell on him. So we're going to have a little experience of Barnabling right now. Alan Cross is the Executive Director of Community Development Initiatives. You can find them at CDIonline.org. Good morning, my brother.
Hey, Carmen, how are you?
I'm well. I'm well. You are a son of encouragement. And this morning, what I would like to talk with you about, I'm going to frame this in 3 questions. So I want us to get real. I want us to get real about the good, the bad, and the ugly of what's happening on the U.S. southern border. So you can take them in any order you want. But the good would be, tell us the good news of what is happening through those who are actually seeking to bring mercy to bear on the situation. Tell us the bad, which is, would be, I think, a story about a person who you met and what they were really fleeing, why they are here, why they are trying to come to America. So that's the good and the bad. And then the ugly is what's really happening in these detention centers, and, you know, and sort of this, the very real need that we all know, that we need comprehensive immigration reform, but these people need something urgent. And so talk with us about the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right. The good that I've seen, as
as far as going to the border, I've been multiple times over the past several months, both to Tijuana and then Nogales, Arizona, and most recently, just a couple weeks ago, to El Paso. And it's to see the church respond the way that it has. You know, people ask, you know, what is the church doing on these issues and how is the church helping? Well, go to the border and you will see churches from McAllen, Texas, all the way to San Diego and Tijuana that have responded, that have are ministering. They've taken their sanctuaries and they are filled with cots and they're receiving migrants, you know, dozens to hundreds a day. They're helping migrants get to other places in the United States. Now, the migrants that have been released into the United States have been released by ICE. They have been through the initial credible fear test, and our own government has allowed them in, and they're working with churches all across the border, from El Paso to places like Phoenix and Yuma, Arizona, and where they have actually networked with churches, and they're turning the migrants over to the churches. They're dropping them off in church parking lots, hundreds at a time, and churches are stepping up. And so that's been really amazing to me and very encouraging. And the church and the rest of America needs to know what our brothers and sisters in Christ are doing at the border. They're working nonstop to help these people. And we need to, you know, we need to understand that and provide whatever support we can. So that's the good. That's the really encouraging part. Do you want me to go straight to the bad, or do you have any questions?
Yeah, man,
about that?
That's okay. The good. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I just think that I want us to sort of get the picture. So there is a response, and I think that that is super encouraging. But there's a response because there's a really bad situation.
Yeah, and there is a response, and we shouldn't just sit back and let people at the border continue. They're overwhelmed. They've been working nonstop. Their resources have been stretched to the limit and beyond, actually. And so there's a real need, just like if there was a major hurricane or disaster or something where, you know, where we flood in, the rest of us, with help, that needs to happen at the border with the churches there. So the bad part of it is that people truly are fleeing horrendous violence and corruption. Peasants are being targeted in these Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. You know, they're being threatened with you know, kidnapping, extortion, you know, murder. They're bringing young people into gangs. They're, you know, going after the girls for sexual exploitation. There's really bad stuff happening, and people are fleeing, and they see that there's hope potentially for asylum in the United States. And so they come, they bring their children, and they're presenting themselves for asylum legally, which is a legal thing to do. So the bad part of the stories that I heard when I was there, and I wasn't, you know, speaking specifically to migrants, you know, just because of the language barrier and things like that. But I talked to quite a few people who were working with them, and to a person, they were saying that the stories that they're hearing really are horrendous, of rape, of murder, of kidnapping, of extortion. And also, too, something that I want to point out that I was told by multiple sources when I was in El Paso is that 50, 60, 75%, depending on the flow, of the migrants who are coming are evangelical Christians, like true brothers and sisters in Christ who are fleeing. And many of them, after you kind of dig down a little bit and talk with them, are saying that they're being targeted because of their faith, not necessarily just an opposition to Christianity, but their evangelical faith perhaps makes them more vulnerable to the cartels and to the gangs. And they tend to go after evangelicals more, especially the poor. And so they don't have any recourse. They have nowhere to go. So they're fleeing north. So that's, you know, some of the bad that I heard. And I was surprised to hear of the percentage of evangelical Christians who are fleeing north and are looking for a rescue and a refuge in the United States. And these really are refugees. We should see this like the refugee crisis a few years ago that was, you know, coming from Syria, that what's driving a lot of these people isn't just that they want a better life, but many of them are fleeing violence. I mean, some of them obviously don't qualify for asylum. Some of them are just kind of getting in the flow and they're coming as well. And so you have to work through that. But there are legitimate situations and cases where people are fleeing violence. And then the ugly of the situation is that we really do have a crisis at the border. It's not so much a security crisis in the sense we're being invaded as it is a humanitarian crisis. And I think our government has begun to adjust to that reality. There's a need for you know, more resources for processing, for asylum judges, for the agencies that work with this to be able to you know, to be better resourced and be better staffed, because everything really is being overwhelmed. Our system is being overwhelmed. And a huge part of our system are the churches at the border. If the churches weren't doing what they were doing, we would have mass chaos. I'm completely convinced of that. And so, it's a real situation that America needs to be aware of. Not in the, oh my goodness, these people are coming, what do we do? You know, as far as how do we keep them out? There are security issues. We do need to address those. But just the flow of people that are coming to us asking for help is has grown quite a bit over the last several months. So,
All right. So, Alan, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, here's what I would like to do. I would like for you to help us think through how we in our local communities and in our churches can get this conversation going, and can particularly we need to become skilled in how to respond non-defensively when somebody, you know, bows up and basically says, you know, you just want to let a bunch of terrible people into the country. Like, we have to have rational responses to what people are afraid of, and we need to work through that. So I know you're really adept at that. So that's the conversation I'd like to have when we come back from the break. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. My conversation partner is Alan Cross. You can find what he is doing at cdionline.org. All right, so joining me, continuing our conversation, is Alan Cross. He is hashtag tell a better story. If you want to find the conversations on social media that Alan is identifying and fanning the flame of and provoking. And so I like him, and I like the way that he helps us understand the issues of the day at the intersection of the Christian faith and real mercy, real, genuine mercy and love for the other. So I want you to check it out at cdionline.org. Alan, help us get this conversation going in our, you know, at our coffee table, in our congregations, in our communities.
Yeah. First of all, it's an awareness that these folks are coming to us. So this is not just a situation at the border. Asylum seekers are coming. They're presenting themselves legally. They're being processed. They're being released to churches along the border, and they're there for just 1 or 2, maybe 3 days tops. And then they're moving on to family members and the people across the country. There was a Washington Post article a few weeks ago where they did a study from Annunciation House in El Paso, which is doing a great job and doing really hard work as far as helping the migrants get to churches in the area. But where were the migrants going? And they studied 1,500 people, and they showed all over the country where they were going. And I'm from Montgomery, Alabama, and I looked, I saw Montgomery, Alabama had a pretty decent size circle there. And they said a lot of Guatemalans were coming to Montgomery. So I contacted some of our Baptist ministry centers that I work with, and they said, yes, they had seen an increase in Guatemalans coming from the border to Montgomery. And these circles are all over the country, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, and all these different places, and they're showing up at bus stations. So we started talking about what can we do to receive people through our ministry centers. And the main thing is that our attitude needs to be exactly what the Bible commands it to be when people come to us in need, is that we welcome them, we minister to them, we open up our hearts and our lives to them instead of standing at a distance and keeping them away from us out of fear. And what we're finding is that a lot of them are brothers and sisters in Christ. This is the church that is coming to us for help. I mean, Matthew 25 is in full effect here as far as what our response should be to people coming to us. You know, there are people in need. There are people you know, struggling. They're poor. Many of them have had incredibly long journeys, and many of them are desperate. And so our heart needs to be that we would receive them in the same way that we would receive Christ, you know, pray with them, encourage them, help them. And those who aren't Christians, many of them are open to becoming Christians, and they would receive that if they would be able to be welcomed and to be loved. I've heard people say that in these churches where the migrants are coming, they're sharing the gospel with people, and the ones who aren't Christians are crying out to the Lord and asking for salvation and for mercy, because they truly are desperate overall. And so anyway, that's just something to be aware of. These are real people, families, children, babies. The church that I went into where the migrants, it was the middle of the afternoon. They had just arrived. They were sleeping. I just saw one of the most difficult scenes that I've ever seen before. And I've been all over the world in lots of really difficult situations, but the babies weren't even crying. They were so exhausted. People were just stretched out sleeping, hollow looks on their faces, empty eyes, and just complete exhaustion was over these people. And the church was ministering to them, helping them and feeding them. And that's what we all need to be doing. This is not just at the border. This is in your town. Go to a bus station, contact your ministry centers, find out who is coming, and then figure out ways that churches can help locally.
Okay. There's nothing so sad. There's just nothing in all the world so sad as a baby who is too fatigued or too hungry or too tired to even cry. Like,
right.
There is nothing so sad as that. And for those of us who have worked in, you know, in, let's say, parts of Africa following droughts that lead to famine, we know what you're talking about. We have held children who are too malnourished, too sad, too tired, too hungry to cry. And
that's what struck me. Yeah, the whole room was filled with people and there wasn't a sound being made and there were babies and children and no one was making a sound. And that's what really, that's what sticks with me to this day, you know?
So Alan, you quickly went through a list of things that obviously are they're so easy for you to call upon, but they're new for a lot of us. So in my own community, while you were talking, I pulled up this Washington Post snapshot of where migrants go after releasing to the United States. I see a giant dot over my own city. It's a giant dot with all of the represented groups, Guatemalans, Hondurans, and Salvadorans. I have apparently folks from all of those countries newly arrived here in my city. And then you said, here's who I call. And you said them really fast, and I want you to repeat them more slowly. Like, who do I call to find out who's here and how to help?
Right. So for me, where I was, I worked with our Montgomery Baptist Association, and we have multiple ministry centers there. And so I just called and said, hey, are you seeing more Guatemalans come? And they said, yes, we are. And they didn't fully understand it either as far as where they're coming from. So I sent them the article and I said, oh, that's exactly what's happening. You know, over the last 6 months, we've had this real uptick in folks. And so we started getting the word out to churches and things like that. And they're trying to minister. I would do some similar things in your city. I don't know who your ministry centers are that work with immigrants or migrants or even just the poor. But that's where I would start. Maybe talk to your church, talk to if you have an outreach pastor or if you're doing ministry like that, or look for churches who are doing that kind of ministry, because they're going to know. You know, this is happening all over. I've talked to people in North Carolina and in other places and asked them, are you seeing this increase? And they're saying, yeah, and we're trying to respond. You know, so you can go to your bus station and they're arriving daily at the bus station in your community. And so if your church isn't doing anything or if you don't know, you have to do a little bit of investigation, figure out what are the main ministries in your city that would be working with these folks or helping. And then if they're not, you know, try to figure out a plan. Just do some scouting. You know, they're arriving on buses is the main thing, because they're getting bus tickets in these places. And some of them are flying in and, you know, the government is getting them to where they need to be. But, you know, they have family waiting for them. They often have people. You can talk to Latino churches but I would bring in your pastor or your outreach pastor or missions pastor, or whatever, and have a conversation and say, this is going on in our city. What can we do to respond? And then you can kind of develop an appropriate response that's sustainable. That's kind of the main thing.
Okay. So, it's a lot to take in. It's a lot to process. But you know, for each and every one of us who knows, frankly, where our next meal is coming from, and we know where we're going to sleep tonight, and we know that our kids are going to have, somewhere to go, and something to do. We are talking about people in a situation where they know none of the answers to those same questions. They don't know where they're going to go to church this Sunday, and they're not sure that Christians in America are prepared to live out the gospel in this particular way. So, Alan Cross, thank you so much again. You guys can get more resources at cdionline.org. We're going to have to leave it right there with Alan, but we'll have you back. Thank you so much. And you guys are listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. So You guys are wondering where you can see if migrants are in your city. I'm looking at a Washington Post article entitled "A Snapshot of Where Migrants Go After Release into the United States." It's a point in time, but you could, you know, Google it. All right, that's all I got time for today. I've completely run out of time. Have a great day. God bless. I'll see you right back here tomorrow on.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.